Welcome to What a Ride with Rupert Guinness and Aaron S. Lee.
Hello, Rup.
G'day, Aaron. Mate. Great to be here, mate.
Oh, same. You know, you just landed from the Giro, right?
Yeah. Another Giro d'Italia. Done and dusted.
And when did you arrive?
I got back on the Wednesday morning, so just about 24 hours ago.
Oh, wow. So just yesterday, eh?
Yeah, but it was great. Italy's a beautiful place to go to, always is. But the Giro is always a race full of surprises.
And this year, more so than ever.
Yeah. I mean, it never ceases to amaze me. But it all makes for good content, good copy, and good storytelling later on.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And of course, obviously, we got to go right to the Giro with that, because there was a lot of things going on, especially around stage 10, I believe, with one Australian Team Sky rider, Richie Porte.
Yeah, Richie, I mean, he had a Giro full of problems, didn't he? You know, actually, even from the beginning, when Sky, you know, had a pretty poor team time trial, losing 22 seconds, but then the time gaps got even worse, didn't they? I mean, he got a 2-minute penalty for that illegal wheel change with Simon Clark, and then on the sprint stage to Gisolo, there was that crash, 3.3 kilometres out from the finish. And Richie lost some time there. But more importantly, he got a lot of injuries. He hurt his hip, his knee, a pinched nerve in the neck. And then we saw the impact of that later on in the time trial the next day. He just wasn't up for it, you know. And then another mountain stage later, he lost 27 minutes plus. And then on the rest day, the second rest day with a week to go, the team decided to pull him out.
And, of course, the internet blew up on what was called a port gate, or the wheel of misfortune, so to speak.
Yeah. It was a wheel of misfortune, two wheels of misfortune for Richie. And I just think that I think it was the wisest thing was to pull him from the race, because the third week is in a Grand Tour, that's where you do most damage to yourself as an athlete, you know. And even if you are fit and healthy, that's where the potential for most damage is going to be made. And Richie at that state, you know, I think he had to concentrate on healing, or recovering and healing, and trying to get ready for the Tour de France.
Of course, you know, he took the wheel from his compatriot, not a teammate, Simon Clark, who was in the leader's jersey after stage four. Obviously, a lot of people were talking about the UCI missed a great opportunity because of the sportsmanship that was displayed. One Eurosport analyst, former pro rider, Juan Antonio Fletcher, he said, look, he goes, it wasn't sportsmanship. It would have been sportsmanship if it was maybe Contador or Aru that did the favor, but it was more so of mateship. What's your take?
Look, I think, the law was there. They did breach the law, you know, and when everyone calmed down a bit, you know, Richie understood that as well, and so did Simon Clark. But I think that the point that I sort of, I agree that the law was a law, but what I felt that the race jury, the UCI race jury, should have been able to do was to exact their discretionary powers to at least reconsider the situation. When they said there was no room for appeal whatsoever, I just don't think that's right. I think there should be some leeway where there can at least be an appeal, which allows for some voice of reason to look at the situation in the aftermath of that initial penalty being handed down. At least that way they can see that. And there was a great opportunity for the sport to come out of it looking really good. It was interesting, the Giro d'Italia Twitter feed initially, mentioned how this is what sport's all about, the Giro's all about. And then obviously the UCI race jury had, you know, stood fast on its position. And it should be remembered, you know, the race organisers aren't the ones to blame. They got the race organisers are not the ones who enforce the penalty. It's the UCI race jury. So it's not the race organisers who should be, you know, held to blame or made accountable or whatever for the rights or wrongs of that decision. It's the UCI race jury. But at the end of the day, Richie Porte and Simon Clark made the wrong mistake. And I just think it shows you've got to know all the laws of the game.
Now, obviously, for those of us back over here in Australia, unlike yourself, who was on the ground there at the Giro, how disappointed was Richie? Because on TV and across in the interviews, he came across with a lot of class and with that typical Tasmanian smile.
Yeah, look, Richie was privately disappointed. I mean, you know, that time trial, I said he didn't. His intent was to do a good time trial. He did show a picture of the Twitter with his Australian champions jersey saying something like inspiration for today. You know, he was motivated to do it, but he said he quickly realised he didn't have the legs. And the decision for him to withdraw wasn't taken lightly. You know, you know, he did indicate to myself after the time trial that he was thinking about the about withdrawing. But that, you know, that would require some serious decision making and consultation with David Brailsford, the team principal, and Tim Kerrison, his coach. And it was interesting that it wasn't until that Monday morning, the Sunday night, the night before the second time trial, late at night at 11 o'clock, Richie was officially told by the team that they've decided to pull him. So it wasn't a decision they made quickly, but it was taken with a lot of consideration, and I think at the end of the day, the right decision was made.
Well, it's definitely not the last that we'll hear from Richie Porte. Nor will it be the last that we'll talk about the Giro on today's show, because you've got some interviews lined up that you recorded while you were over in Italy, and we'll be getting to those later in the show. We've got a jam-packed show. For those of everyone listening for the first time, look, we've got It's What a Ride, and basically it's based off one of your books.
Yeah, just the book I wrote about my years of the pursuit of an Aussie chasing the Tour de France, or chasing Tour de France victory. And got to say, there was a point there I thought it wasn't going to happen, but 2011, Cadel Evans came up with the goods. And, you know, fantastic year that was. I remember reporting on that. That was a great experience, but the whole journey's been experienced, and when you say what a ride, it has been an incredible journey. And I just think what a ride's about the journey in your life, journey in sport, and everything. It's a fabulous experience, even with the lows. You know, you get the highs and the lows, but it's great.
And of course, we're not just going to talk about cycling on this show.
No.
We're going to talk a little bit about everything. If it's a bike, a board, a ski, anything, we're going to cover it. If you run it, bike it, swim it.
If you ride it,
we're on it.
We're on it.
Absolutely. And we're going to cover a little bit of everything. Obviously, we're also huge fans and journalists in the sport of triathlon as well. We're going to have and talk about triathlon later on the show. I think we're going to have, first off, thebike.com publisher and editor Phil Rockner on the show. And he's going to talk a little bit about the state of affairs for the Road to Rio, and a little bit about the controversy around the Triple Crown series, what they're calling it, with Challenge. So this is going to be an interesting show. We're going to have more of that when we come back from break. In the meantime, stay tuned for more What a Ride.
Side of our lives, where nothing is ever put straight.
And we're back from break. You're listening to What a Ride with Rupert Guinness and Aaron S. Lee. We're going to take a little bit of a time out and just kind of introduce our program or producer, Andy Brown. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, guys. Pleasure being here. The debut show.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're a ride. You're a bit of the brains behind the beauty here.
Oh, I wouldn't call it that.
What, the beauty or the brains?
Both. Yeah. Now, I have a face for radio.
Oh, I think we all do. I think that's why we're on this show. And Matt Keenan and Scott McGorry have their own shows on TV.
So that's right. Yeah, not bonny enough for TV.
No, exactly. You know, you've got a... tell us a little bit about Australian broadcast media, how it started.
Australian broadcasting media really has only been set up as a company maybe 7 years. But before that, there was three of us involved. There's me, of course, a guy called Sean Ison, and he's been in radio and writing software for radio since he left school. And there's a guy called Keith Ashton, and he was on the pirate radio ships in the English Channel, and he was off the coast of Israel on the Voice of Peace.
There was a movie about that,
there
wasn't
was, it? Yes, The Boat That Rocked. He was a good egg. It was called The Good Egg on there, yeah. But unfortunately, he's passed away. But we still have his voice, and we use it on radio, so he's still with us.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. We started with one listener, that was me. And now we've grown to, we have 36 FM radio stations around Australia.
More than 200 digital.
More than 200 digital, yes.
And of course, our show is available on demand via iTunes as well.
Yes, and it'll be on our Radio Sydney site.
Absolutely.
So you can download it anytime you want from there. We'll be playing you as well. We'll get your own show. So hopefully this is going to be something, start something large, because we'd like you guys on all the time.
What kind of music do you listen to? What's your bag?
Oh, good heavens, where do we start? So where do we stop, really? Yeah. I'm interested in all types of music. I don't think there's any one particular genre that we adhere to and I prefer above anything else. But just for instance, on Radio Sydney, we have 250 genres of music. So I started off liking house music and dance music and Northern Soul music.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Tamla Motown, where it all started from there, I suppose. And anything linked to that, if it's a toe tapper, I like it.
Yeah, speaking of toe tappers, now I'm a huge Depeche Mode fan.
Right,
that British electronic music from the 80s. Yeah, and I'm afraid that my iTunes playlist reflects that. I almost quit listening to the radio in 1990.
I'm telling
my age there a bit. But huge Seems fan, pop. Absolutely, huge fan of this. New Order, Joy Division, The Cure. But recently, while Roop was away at the Giro, we had four straight nights sold out. Didn't manage to get any tickets for Morrissey, former lead singer of the Smiths. Now, there's some bad reviews.
Well, I read a review and they weren't very keen on him. They thought he was a bit flat, rather dull, you know. But, how old is he now? You know, some of the fire's gone, obviously.
It's hard to sing about
poverty when you're a very rich man, isn't it?
Absolutely. So do you think bad reviews are a good review, Rube?
That's what they say, isn't it?
Yeah, well, but bad news is good news.
Yeah.
Well, he was at the Opera House. I had a chance to catch Morrissey back in 2000. I'm going to get this wrong now, and I'm sure people on Twitter will correct me. But I had a chance to see him in Austin, Texas. And I want to say 2008, 2009. And it was a small venue there, and it was an absolutely fantastic show. I feel that they just don't make music that way anymore, and I sound like my dad, and now I realize that I'm old man now.
Right,
I say things like that.
Moz, remember it's called Moz.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Was he with the Smiths then? Was it the Smiths or was it just Morrissey?
Oh, it was just Morrissey. Yeah, right, he hasn't been with the Smiths since 20 years ago.
Yeah, he rose to prominence in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah, he was fantastic.
He'd lose a lot with
Johnny. What do you listen to?
Oh, you know, I mean, I'm a very open-minded, broad-minded...
You're a man of the world is what
I'm,
you are.
I'm a man of love. Yeah. A person of love.
Yeah, as a matter of fact...
World peace.
Yeah, you're a big Barry White fan.
No, I do like my Barry White. I do.
You do.
I do. Don't knock it, mate.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
You know, You know, are you actually trained to Barry White? Is that no?
No, I don't train to Barry White. I need something a bit more sort of, you know,
upbeat.
Actually, I don't. To be honest, when I train, I don't listen to music.
No. Nothing at all.
Because when you race, you don't listen to music, do you? So you got to, you know, you got to be ready to race as you got to train as you race.
No, anyway. Absolutely. Well, I agree with that. Listen, and we're going to take a short break. We'll go back to sport when we get back. Back to What a Ride with Rupert Guinness and Aaron S. Lee. Rup, you know, while you've been away at the Giro, I've been holding the fort down here in Sydney. Everything is under control. I got back from the tour of Turkey, the 51st presidential tour of Turkey, in fact, and had been laying low, been watching the Giro, watching you on Eurosport's Facebook page with your nice little video clips, and you know, you did a great job.
Oh, thanks, mate. They were on the Fairfax Media site as well.
Oh, just fantastic. Let you
know. Yeah, but anyway, yeah. No, it was good fun. It was a nice little... I mean, it's a nice opportunity. The Giro goes to some great places, and it's a nice way of being able to show that not just that you're there, but it gives a bit of the atmosphere of the background of where you are and the scene setter, I suppose, for the stories that you're writing.
And we've already talked about it. You just returned from Italy yesterday, back to Sydney. I leave tomorrow morning for the tour to Korea, and it's I should know this, but I think it's a UCI Asia Tour 2.1.
Yeah,
2.1
yeah,
race.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a lot of big teams there. In fact, only one World Tour team, but that World Tour team being Orica Green Edge.
Yep, and it's it's an important race. It's an important race for those riders in that team, one of whom is Caleb Ewan, I understand.
Oh, absolutely. Caleb will be there. You know, it's been an interesting first year for Caleb as a pro, neo-pro for Orica Green Edge. He did start with the team late last year, but this is his first full season. You know, we talked to him, I guess, prior to the season, and we were under the impression, and he said this, and I think Matty White, the team sports director, he said the same thing. They were only expecting or wanting about 5 or so wins out of him this year. No pressure. He got those wins early on. We saw him, you know, get some of those wins, obviously, at the Herald Sun Tour. And then I caught up with him and had a chance to see those wins in Langkawi. Since then, it's been a bit sparse. You caught up with him right before the Tour of Turkey.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, at that point, he was struggling a bit because he was saying how, you know, like, for example, he did... Tour of Catalonia, which was a World Tour race, and he said he was having trouble with the speed of the peloton on the climbs, and I think he was feeling the accumulated fatigue from all that as well. But I think going into the season, he knew it was going to be like this. He may not have known exactly what it was going to be like, but he knew it was going to be a challenging year on that front. And I do know that the Green Edge, Orica Green Edge, have styled a program for him which is going to put him at the cold face of what it's really about, but also have a balance of races where he can go in there with a view of winning races. And we've seen him get close to a couple of, you know, to Cav on first stage of
Turkey.
And then later in Norway, he got up close to Christoph once, you know. So, but then he tends to sort of fade out again. So I think that effort is obviously, to back up again. You've got to have that sheer strength.
And in all fairness, he's what, 20 years old?
Yeah,
he's not even 21, is he? I mean, he's still a young rider.
Very much so.
And also, in all fairness to Orica Green Edge, he's a new sprint train. You know, these guys are all coming together for the first time. He's got a veteran like Adam Blythe, the British rider. He's got guys like Lee Howard and the Dutch rider Magnus Cort, who's an amazing talent in his own right as a sprinter. So we've got to give them time. You know, you can't compare them obviously to Marcel Kittel's train or an Andre Greipel or obviously a Cavendish, can you?
No, exactly. And I just think it's I think. This year we have to give Caleb a bit of breathing space to just find out what it's like. And if he does dip in form or dip in morale, I doubt he's morale. He's a positive sort of guy. But if he does, he's got to discover that for himself. That's how you get your bookends of emotions and experience. You've got to feel the struggle and the hurt and the disappointments to get a grasp of the success and then appreciate the success that you do get. And I think he will get it in years to come.
Well, I'll tell you what, you only have to spend about 5 minutes with Caleb Ewan to know that he's got a lot of confidence.
Yeah.
And he's a very well-poised young man. Now, that being said, could it be a lot of pressure on him at a race like Korea when they're the only World Tour team there? On paper, he should win, but he's not the only sprinter there. Drapac Cycling, another Australian team, a Pro Conti team, they've got a young man.
Yeah, Wouter Whippet. And he's been doing pretty well this year. And, Drapac are going to be going there, expecting to win as well. There will be pressure on them to win. They've got to step up and perform, and there will be pressure on Caleb. So this is, Korea's going to be one of those races where he's going to have to go in there carrying that load of expectation. So there will be pressure on him in this race. We're talking about the whole season of not putting too much pressure on him. But he's got to have pressure points, and Korea is really important for that. And I think it'll be interesting to see how he's rebounded from, you know, the bigger races he's been doing in Europe for Korea.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, and of course, Walter, he'll have a great lead-out guy as well, an Australian Olympian, Graham Brown, who's confirmed to be there as well. Also be looking forward to the Continental team, the New Zealand-based Continental team, Avanti Racing. I follow the Avanti guys. I'm a big fan of what they do, especially Andrew Christie Johnston and Steve Price. For those of you know the people who aren't aware, this is a storied franchise dating back to the early 2000s from Tasmania, actually. And they've had some great talent come through those ranks. I mean, obviously, one of the guys we mentioned earlier in the show, one Richie Port, then, of course, Nathan Haas, guys from Cannondale Garmin. We've got Nathan Earl, Port's teammate at Sky. There's been some great talents come through there.
Yeah, no,
Steele Von Hoff.
It's been great for Australian cycling. Well, now it's, as you say, New Zealand cycling.
Yeah.
But either way, that team being there, it's been a great development pathway for those guys who've got gigs. And, you know, I mean, obviously they don't all succeed over there. They do. Some of them do come back. But the point is they get that opportunity to go. Because I think once you're over there, it's up to yourself to whether you... I wouldn't say succeed or fail, but whether you make a fist of it or whether you feel that your future isn't really there in Europe and you come back. So I've never got anything but admiration for anyone who will give it a crack over in Europe. So the guys who do come back, you know, it's not that they've failed. It's just that it's been a reality check and they feel their future's here back in Australia or at another level of team. And that's fine because it's such a hard sport anyway at any level.
Absolutely. You know, we talked about Avanti having a good talent back in the past. They have a lot of talent now as well. Two of the top names that come to my mind is obviously the defending reigning national champion or National Road Series champion, Joe Cooper, but also one Patrick Bevan, who has shown he has got a lot of horsepower. I understand he's pushing about 450 watts, which is a lot. Yeah. It's a massive amount of wattage for a young man. And then they also have young triathlete turned roadie, another Kiwi, and Tom Davidson. And we'll get into triathlon later. Let's go back a little bit to Orca Green Edge. We were talking about Matty White's expectations of Caleb Ewan. You had a chance to catch up with Matty at the Giro.
Yeah, I had a good chat to Matt about, you know, it was a little bit of a spiel about what, you know, how the Giro was going for Orica Green Edge and how it went. And I've got to say, you know, it was a pretty successful Giro. Obviously started well with 4 days in the pink jersey, 2 stage wins. You know, Michael Matthews went well. The team time trial, they lived up to the expectation as favourites and jagged that win. And I thought it also interesting that in the third week, Orica Green Edge had a presence, not a dominating presence, but their objective was to try and get their climbers, Peter Weening, Simon Clark, I guess their medium mountain climbers, and also Esteban Chavez, their Colombian guy, you know, into moves in that last week. And they achieved that. They were all in moves in that last week. None of those moves stayed away because the teams of Astana and Tinkoff Saxo were chasing all the breaks back. But they did that, and the Giro obviously ended with Luke Durbridge getting second place in that last stage where him and the Belgian rider Case kept the peloton at bay, which was a pretty interesting move by them. But Matt White, yeah, I spoke to him also just about himself and his, you know, his job as a sports director, which is pretty much like a head coach of a football team. And we spoke a bit about that and how he felt he adapted to that job after being a domestic or a helper in cycling. And also some of the you know, lessons he's learnt from other sports, one of whom was the NRL Roosters coach, Trent Robinson, who came on board in his car at the Two Down Under. And I know they're very good mates. They've been mates for a while. And Robbo, he has a good interest in cycling as well. So so we had a chat to him about that. So it was an interesting little piece, I think.
Well, let's go to that interview now, Rupe.
All the way. What a ride. I'm talking with Matt White, the head sports director of Australia's Orica Green Edge team. Matt, thanks a lot for coming on to What a Ride. We're talking at the Giro d'Italia, but very soon the Tour de France is coming up. I was just wondering, from your job as head sports director, how do you sort of deal from the objectives and the goals and the outcomes of one Grand Tour? At the same time, you've got to shift across pretty quickly to another mindset for the Tour de France.
Yeah, we will use some riders from the Giro at the Tour de France, but we've also got another group of guys preparing with separate goals and separate lead-ins for the tour as well. So, you know, cycling's a very dynamic sport, and we've got 27 riders. We do 200 plus days of racing. So, yeah, it's all about the planning, and that started last year.
Obviously, with Orica Greenedge, I mean, it's been quite a ride since its start in 2012. When you look back on those 3 years now, how do you sort of feel the team's evolved and where can it go to in the future?
Yeah, I think we definitely have evolved on a lot of fronts. We're obviously very proud of where we've come from and what we've achieved so far, but I think we're evolving more into a team that can, in the future, target 3 week stage races. We can obviously, with the Yates brothers and Esteban Chavez, we're already, you know, we're on the verge of podium world tour events with those young guys, and you know, we've got the likes of Albasini and Gerrans and Matthews who already have, you know, won some very big 1 day races and Peter Weening have won some great world tour events already.
Obviously, with your job and your experience, the role that you had as a cyclist was as a domestique. I guess there's a lot of the experiences you had from that job that sort of helped you be equipped to do what you do now, because you've got an understanding of everybody's role within a team.
Yeah, definitely. And I think if you look at the successful sports directors in history, most of those guys haven't been the big champions, because a lot of big champions, they don't understand or can't relate to younger riders who are struggling. So I thought the riders who are the domestiques or the people, the middlemen, they can relate to a 21-year-old neo-pro who's going through tough times in his first year or two. Or they can relate to a big champion because they've directly worked with those guys and those sort of personalities. So it definitely helped my transition from a rider to my role on this side of the fence.
What about with the Tour de France? We often see the glamour. We see the mountains, the crowds, the victory for stage wins or even for the overall, and the circus of the whole event. But, you know, at the other end of the race, there's a lot of human suffering, emotionally and physically. You know, you've probably experienced that yourself, and I just wonder if you can give an example or two of something that sort of left an imprint in your mind that still helps you, you know, bookend that feeling about the Tour de France.
Yeah, I enjoyed 3 week stage races. I think they're a different beast on their own. The 1 day races, there's a different type of pressure. You've got to be ready on that day and for those 4 or 5 hours. The 1 week stage races, again, the pressure is spread out over the 5 days. Whereas the Tour de France, and especially the Tour de France, it's the best way to explain the Tour de France. It's a classic every day. And I love the fatigue and the challenge of getting through those races, and I suppose I like in passing on that enthusiasm to my riders. And we've got a very tight-knit group, and I think we achieve very, very high standards because we are so tight and we've got a similar focus. And unlike some teams, we can change who the leader is. We can adapt to different plans, different scenarios, and we've got the egos in our team that the boys will commit to whatever plan is given to them.
So I guess that helps a lot of the riders sort of be honest with you and their teammates to say, if they're a leader and they say, look, I'm not up to it today, or they feel they've let the team down, they'll put their hand up. Whereas, you know, and other riders who may not necessarily always get an opportunity in other teams, they may get one in Orica Greenedge.
Yeah, definitely, and I think that's one of our strengths, and that's why it has become a very attractive team for a lot of good riders wanting to come here, because they can see that everyone gets a chance on this team.
Now, your job as head sports director, ostensibly, you know, for a general audience, it's like the head coach of a football team. I was wondering, do you take any, is there anything you learn or you garner from any particular football coach or coaches in other sports that sort of you're able to put into practice?
Yeah, I'm a sports fan in general. I love sport in general. I follow lots of different sports. But yeah, I think when I'm trying to learn things all the time, and I've got a few friends in different sports, and it's interesting to sort of pick their brain on how they manage certain situations, and likewise asking me, because every sport is a little bit different, and ours is certainly a very dynamic sport. The way it's run, the logistics, the amount of changes of programs within the riders and staff. But yeah, I think you never stop learning, and when you think you've mastered all, I think that's when you get overtaken.
I know at the Tour Down Under you had a certain Trent Robinson in your car, the coach of the Roosters. He was at the Tour Down Under to try and, you know, learn stuff for himself. Did he pass on any sort of knowledge to you that you've been able to put into practice in the last couple of months?
Yeah, look, Robbo took me around the Roosters, their setup last in the off season, and I invited him down to Down Under. We're mates, we've known each other for a long time. And yeah, he wanted to see how we do things from the inside, and likewise the Roosters.
Can you elaborate a bit more? I mean, a couple of inside stories there.
Nothing that comes to mind. Nothing that comes to mind.
And just lastly, Matt, we'll come back to you, later on in the show another day. But just a quick word about for the Tour de France. You'd like to get the yellow jersey stage wins. I realise it's not a simple thing to do. Where are you tracking with a view to the team evolving into being a team that could support a Grand Tour rider?
Yeah, I think we're developing well. I think this year our goal is to win stages. And that's very clear this year, but it's also about developing our young guys so that in one, two, no matter how many years it is, that they are ready for that big challenge.
Okay, Matt. Well, thanks a lot for being on What a Ride. It's been great to sort of see this Team Orica Green Edge develop to where it is, and really looking forward to some exciting times ahead. And during the Tour de France, we'll stay in touch, okay? Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Well, there you heard it. Matt White. I can tell you what, anybody who knows Matt White will know that you can sit there all day and talk to him. And he'll talk all day too, but all good stuff.
No, absolutely. Always insightful hearing from Matty White, and thank you for sharing with that, Rupe.
That's my pleasure.
Well, let's go to commercial break. When we come back, we're going to switch gears a little bit. We're going to talk a bit about triathlon. Don't worry. We're going to come back to the Giro a bit later, but we are going to talk a little bit about triathlon, and we've got a couple of special guests coming on. We're going to try to get them on the phone now, and when we come back, in the meantime, stay tuned for more What a Ride. Welcome back to What a Ride with Rupert Guinness and Aaron S. Lee.
It's great to be. I'm enjoying this ride, I can tell you for sure.
Yeah, it's fantastic, yeah. Rupert. I tell you what, you got to be glad to be back home in Sydney, though, after a long work trip, being away. Do you ever get tired of being on the road?
No, I love being on the road.
Yeah?
I really do. I mean, it's just, I mean, sport's such a great, you know, industry to be involved in, and it takes you to so many fantastic places, particularly bike races and triathlons, you know. But saying that, you know, Sydney's a beautiful city to fly back into. It really is.
Absolutely. And I had a chance to enjoy a little bit of Sydney last night. I got a chance to go to the Govinda's, isn't it, Andy? Is it Govinda's restaurant in Darlinghurst?
That's right, yes. Do they have a cinema in there?
They do, actually. So upstairs is this very uber cool, edgy vegetarian buffet. I'm not sure exactly what style of food. I couldn't decipher if it was Indian or what, but it was definitely vegetarian. And they're known for that. But downstairs, they have what's called a movie room and a cinema. And instead of the traditional cinema seats, they're cushions. Lounges. Yeah. Have you guys been?
No, I haven't. What about the Lotus? There's the Lotus room as well.
Yeah, I've never been there.
The yoga and
maybe I'm not enjoying Sydney like I thought. But now, Andy, you've been to the...
I've been to a long, long time ago. It must be, good heavens, that's been going quite a few years, at least 20 years.
It's quite popular. Now, I've been around the corner to the Victoria room, which is quite swanky, a bit of a kind of a 1920s feel to it, or should I say a Victorian era feel, actually. But that being said, I was there last night for a launch night or a fundraising night for an all-women's team called the Velaroos. Now, the Velaroos are four Australian women, and which is, I think one's from Ireland and one's from South Africa, but it's neither here nor there.
No.
But they're all residents of Australia.
They're facts. You just don't worry.
Absolutely,
about facts.
We don't worry about facts here. And they were there because they're going to race across America.
Wow.
And that's at one epic race, and we're talking 3,000 miles, over 4,800 kilometers. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Rupert, but I think it's across 12 states. It's from Los Angeles or California to Maryland. Mm. The winners, you can do it either solo, male or female, teams, mixed, or all one gender, and it's teams of 2, 4, or 8, I believe. These women are going to do it, again, the first all-Australian team to do it. One of their team riders, Sarah Matthews, who unfortunately wasn't able to make it last night, she's done it before. She actually did it last year on a mixed team. She got a bit of unfinished business. She's going to come back this year and do it. She's recruited some girls, and it's going to be one heck of a ride.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's incredible. I mean, I remember that event when I first started covering cycling. I used to read about it in the old Winning magazine, which I ended up editing a bit later. But I mean, so it's, you know, it's an event with a lot of history. But and they ride right through the night as well.
Yeah, absolutely, around the clock
on open roads
too.
I mean, they've got to address issues of security and all that sort of stuff. It's quite a phenomenal event.
And for those of you listening that aren't familiar with Race Across America, please do yourself a favor and download, buy, whatever kids do these days to watch a movie, Bicycle Dreams. 2009, Stephen Arbuck, the director, the producer, and it's a gripping, thrilling, it's an amazing movie. This is a dangerous race, Rupe. There's not any support cars other than for race officials. The riders have support vehicles and staff. But it's an open road across the United States, and unfortunately, riders have died.
Yeah, and it's totally understanding that they don't shy away from the fact that it is dangerous. I mean, to say otherwise would be irresponsible. I mean, they are, they openly say that it is a dangerous event. They have to be careful for their own security. And interesting, when they come into towns and everything, they've got to abide by the law of the road. And so I think there's a big message there, too, about riding responsibly and safely.
We've got Julianne Haslett on the line, one of the Velaroos. Julianne, welcome to What a Ride.
Hi, thank you.
Hey, I had a chance to meet you guys last night in Sydney for one of your fundraisers, and it had a movie night and a beautiful dinner. After watching that movie, I've got to ask you, what are you guys thinking?
Hard, so I think we're ready to get going now.
I mean, I know the distance is about 3,000 miles. What's that in kilometers? Do you know yet?
4,828.
And you know it by heart, don't it? Right down to the last one. Now, I've got to ask you, now you guys are the first all-female Australian team, correct?
That's correct.
Now, Julianne, you don't sound Australian.
I don't know what you're talking about. I've got a really thick, ugly accent.
Yeah, so do I. Now, listen, just introduce...
I'm originally from Northern Ireland, but I've lived here for 15 years.
Oh, fantastic. Introduce, now, who else is on the team? And how did you guys come together?
We all met through triathlon. So Sarah and I are in the same triathlon club, Coogee Triathlon Club in the Eastern Suburbs of Sydney. And I met Natasha originally racing in Ironman 70.3 in Cairns. And Nicole Stannard and I have raced against each other in many races all over Australia.
Well, you know, of course you guys are triathletes. It would only take a triathlete to do something so crazy as to race across the United States. Roop, you're a triathlete. What do you think about this? Would you do it?
Oh, look, no way. Well, we'd like to know, though, Julianne, is how you actually train for this. I mean, obviously you've got endurance. You're endurance athletes, but to get ready for almost 5,000 kilometres, I mean, how do you know that you've done the training and what training is involved? What are some of the, like you haven't done, you said Sarah's done it, but what are some of the inherent challenges that are out there? Obviously the distance is and the climbing is going to be hard.
And, of course, you guys are going to cross several mountain ranges, including right off the bat, you'll be going over to the Rockies. But then later on, you'll also go over the Appalachian Mountains, which aren't as high, but perhaps a bit steeper at points, correct?
They are very steep, yes. So they can be make or break. And after 5 days of virtually no sleep, and when you're really tired, heading the Appalachians is definitely going to be difficult.
And what kind of bikes do you take for this? Is it you taking a time trial bike, or do you take a traditional road bike with maybe some aero bars? Oh, fantastic.
And you also, you ride into the night as well, don't you?
Absolutely. So we ride 24/7, or what we hope will be 7 days, and hopefully get from one side to the other in that time. And we have a 9 days as the cutoff. So if we don't make it in 7 days, we still have another 2 days to play with.
And to put this in perspective, this is a very dangerous ride as well. I mean, you know, people have died on this route, correct?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, there have been a number of deaths.
because the roads are not blocked off. This is not,
no.
You know, you guys are riding with the traffic the entire width of the country.
That's correct.
So how do you put in place the security for you there? And what happens when you come into a town and there's a red light there? Do you sneak through or do you...
No, absolutely not. So we have to actually complete Watford when we're at a red light. And if you don't, there are RAM police along the route. And if you are seen to go through even a give way sign without stopping properly, you will get a penalty.
Oh, that's a good thing.
Now, Julianne, this is not a inexpensive outing. This is, you guys are taking the four riders, but you're also taking a pretty good, a massive support crew, and you can let us know those numbers. But how much are you looking at? And then, again, maybe tell us how the listeners can, you know, log in or find your fundraising page and help support and follow you guys. And of course, you
slightly more than that.
And people can log on where and find you guys and help follow and donate. Fantastic. Julianne.
Oh, just one, like, just, I guess there's some other Aussie teams as well, some other Aussies. Do you know, is there a sort of a unity between all those teams, or are you just pretty much...
Well, just curious, is there any prize money in this thing, or are you guys just doing it for the love of the sport? Oh, fantastic. Well, hey, listen, good luck to you guys, and thanks for joining us. I'm sure we'll catch up for them. I understand you guys have a film crew following you guys as well, correct? Well, you said it, Julianne, not us. But anyway, thank you so much for joining us.
All the best, Julianne.
And good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome back to What a Ride with Rupert Guinness and Aaron S. Lee. Rupe, you know, we're still talking triathlon coming out of the break now, and I want to continue the last segment where we were talking to Julianne Haslett, one quarter of the Velo-Ruse, an all-women Australian team that's going to go and race the race across America. They're former triathletes. I mentioned before the break that God, the triathletes, they must have a screw loose. But that being said, it was all tongue-in-cheek because we both have triathlon very near and dear to our heart.
Yeah, also, I've always thought you had a screw loose, Aaron.
Fair enough. You wouldn't be the first time. I get that on Twitter every day.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. I nice change of pace always, isn't it? The sport's really interesting because it's going through a lot of changes at the moment. You know, both at Olympic distance and also at Ironman distance, and it's a constantly evolving sport, and it's so there's so many bits and parts to it. From the equipment to the race components to how the people race and the tactics and strategies.
And while we love to participate and cover the sport of triathlon, probably no one has their finger on the pulse of the sport better than our next guest, Phil Rockner, the editor and publisher of First Off the Bike. Phil, welcome to the show.
Good, guys. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Listen, a lot going on in the world of triathlon. Catch us up. London just happened. We've got the Road to Rio is about to start. I mean, we're just a little more than a year away. I mean, you're on top of the sport, firstoffthebike.com. What's your take on the landscape of the sport?
Short course racing, I think we're seeing two things. I think we're seeing the reemergence of Alistair Brownlee, who just wins for fun. There's not a lot of science behind what he does. He just goes and beats people up athletically. He's still the benchmark. Javier Gomez, of course, from Spain, he's a good racer, but, there's something about that Brownlee guy. When he gets it right, he just gets it right. He has the courses dialed in. He has the training dialed in, and then he seems to be, again, unstoppable. I mean, I don't think it'll be as easy as London was the last Olympics, but it's hard to see, especially with the Rio bike course being a little bit more difficult than London. It's going to be hard to see him getting beaten. And the women's side, we're seeing the emergence of this US team, this team that's been coached by Australians, which is great to see Australians coaching other teams to victory. And this women's team has just taken all before it. And the second time in London, they've clean swept a race.
Yeah, Gwen Jorgensen is on the women's side. She has been so dominant, Phil. I think she's up to 10 wins now, ITU.
Yeah, she's emulating the likes of Emma Carney, Vanessa Fernandez, of course, Emma Snowsill, who, you know, was one of those dominant athletes, because she runs like a runner. She doesn't run like a triathlete. And I think that separates her. She can put a minute or more into, you know, into anybody. And I think that confidence that she has is showing in her racing. It also plays psychologically on everybody else, because they know she's riding in that front pack. If she swims well and she rides in that front pack, then they are not going to win. It's as simple as that. They're just not going to beat her. And psychologically, she has a lot of the races figured out before she even starts.
Well, she's almost taken a page out of the Brownlees and Gomez's playbook, hasn't she?
Yeah, she has. I mean, she's not as brutal as Alistair Brownlee. The Brownlee boys are threatening. They race threateningly, if I can use that analogy. You know, they dare people to do things to beat them. They yell and scream on the bike. They get things organised. They attack. They're very animated. Whereas, you know, Jorgensen just knows that if she gets off the bike anywhere near the lead, she's going to win. She just knows it. She was sick in London this weekend, just gone, and she still managed to have the win. So for mine, it's a different style of racing. It's not as brutal, but it's so effective. And, you know, you look at what the Americans are doing with the women. What they decided to do was pick off the collegiate athletes who couldn't quite crack it in their given sport, swim, bike or run. And basically what they decided to do was get them involved and get them involved in triathlon. And what we're seeing is girls like Tomlin, Zaviris, these women are just red-hot runners as well. So Jordan's going to have some very, very able lieutenants when she goes out and races.
Hey, g'day, Phil. It's Rupert here, mate. Listen, you're saying how the Brownlees, you know, yell and scream and all that sort of stuff. I mean, what, they're yelling at the other riders and the other triathletes? And if so, how do the others respond to them?
Well, what can you respond when they're going up the road? There's no response to these guys. You know, we spoke to Chris McCormack when he was trying to make the Olympics for London. He gave us the inside word and basically said that these guys were absolutely committed to doing everything they can to win. And what they do is when they get out on the course route, they just line everybody up. And if you're not working, they literally tell you to jump off the line. And they're very aggressive with how they approach a race. And they're not aggressive guys off the bike. They're fantastic blokes to talk to, and we've interviewed them a few times. And they're really good guys. They just know when they get into that athletic sphere, there's got to be a little bit of swagger about them. And who would blame them? Because they're so gifted at swim, bike and run.
Is this like sledging in triathlon, is it?
Do you know, there's this story, this famous myth that kind of goes through, you know, where Jan Frodeno, the gold medal winner, got in a breakaway with the Brownlees, and then the Brownlees apparently turned around and just gave him a mouthful because he wasn't doing much work. You know, they've got no time for people who aren't going to help and be committed to their cause to break up the racing, and they know it as well. You know, Richard Murray and Mola from Spain and also Gomez are tough runners, but, you know, they know if they can get a break early and break up the race, the odds of those guys coming through are going to be lower.
Yeah, you had a chance to spend some time with the US guys down in Geelong recently, did you not?
Yeah, I spent a little bit of time with the US development team and just watched what they did. And we talked about their collegiate careers and we watched them. We went out and actually had a swim with them, which was ridiculous. Trying to keep up with those guys was crazy because they're so quick. But we talked about what they were doing, and in fact, basically their mandate is to just to go around and find the could have been, you know, find the ones who really couldn't get it done at a collegiate level, at the elite end. So, you know, a lot of these women and men are super, super quick runners, but they're never going to be in that top two or three in the American collegiate system. So what do they do? They want to go and do something else, and they have the opportunity. There's that talk about Craig Mottram a couple of years ago becoming a triathlete because of his monster run leg, you know, and that was that idea, that transition athlete was still around. And now what the US guys are doing, through guys like Jared Evans, who's an Australian, you know, through those guys, are realising the fact that these are talented people.
You know, let's switch gears out of the ITU for a second, that road to Rio. Let's talk a little bit about full distance and half distance. Challenge Series has been in the news a lot over the last 6 months, especially with the whole Triple Crown. That's a bit of an issue around that right now with $1 million on the line, but they've had some issues. Fill us in.
Well, the Triple Crown, as we've started to call it, it's fallen to pieces a little bit, I think, in terms of, you know, when Challenge decided they'd do this, they started a three-race series in the Middle Eastern region. They went to Bahrain, Dubai, Oman, and they would have $1 million if you can get the three races done. Well, Bahrain was a huge success. They kept talking about raising the bar. They did. They raised the bar. The stand of athlete that was there was phenomenal. They raced it late in the season. So if you'd raced Kona or Hawaiian Ironman, you'd actually still get your legs right to go and race this one. they put I think 80,000 on the nose. If you could get the three done, they'd put a million. Move off Bahrain, which is a great success, to Dubai, which was just a nightmare. Athletes cut the course, went the wrong way. They had this kind of kangaroo court afterwards. It really wasn't decided properly. There was no rules in place. Winners were, and people were disqualified and lost time, penalties, etc. And so the shine really went off. And especially with the coverage too. The coverage which they boasted about so broadly was shambolic, to say at least. It was a horrible coverage. They were calling athletes who were second and third as the leaders of the race. They had no clear understanding from the course what was happening. Everybody spent the day scrambling. Fast forward to Oman, which was supposed to happen in August. That's now been moved. Obviously, there is some civil unrest around that area, given that it borders Yemen, and there's not probably not a triathlete in the world who'd want to go and risk going over there at the moment, given the unrest there. That's an unfortunate state of affairs, but certainly a good move by the Challenge people to move it. No announcement's been made there. No announcement's been made after Dubai as to whether who's capable of winning the $1 million, and it certainly has lost a lot of the shine that Challenge tried to put onto a race. And look, I've got to preface that by, I guess, or tag on to say, well done to the Challenge guys for trying to get something up and trying to get something big and trying to get something exciting, but it just hasn't worked.
Yeah, it's a shame about Oman, isn't it, Phil? Because I've been there a couple of times for the Tour of Oman cycling, and it's got some great roads, and the countryside's beautiful. It's got some nice hills. The water's great. And the actual people, I mean, they've got a real culture there. Like, unlike when you go to Qatar, I've been to Qatar, for example, and it's, I haven't got a big rap on Qatar. You know, there's not much there, but you go to Oman it's a real country with real culture, and it's a beautiful place. I always thought it would be a great place to go there and have triathlons or cycle races, which they already do.
Yeah, look, you're right. They just don't want to run the risk. Mm. And there's a lot of American athletes going out there. They just don't want to have that. And I think that's the right decision. I think if you're unsure about a place anywhere in the world, I think the first duty of care is to those who are going to come to your race. And, the Challenge people have felt that it's not a worthwhile risk. They've been, the guys who are bankrolling this, are not confident about it either. A lot of the shine came off after Dubai with the, talking to a lot of people who are out there that even the people in Dubai weren't happy with it. It's just really fallen on hard times, this. And they've been noticeably quiet about it for the last couple of months. And, that's not the great thing, because then the story's written for them. I think they probably needed to come out and actually talk about it being on track and how is it coming on track and where is it now. Because at the moment, your guess is as good as mine as to what's going to happen to this Triple Crown. And more importantly, who's eligible for it? After the Dubai debacle, who actually has the right to shoot for race two and three?
Mm. Absolutely. Phil, we could talk triathlon all day with you, mate. Thanks so much for coming on. We hope you come back and talk to us again. For the listeners, where can they find you? First off the bike.
Yeah, firstoffthebike.com. And, always love having a chat to you guys. It's nice to see you guys getting something up and about for the sport, both two wheels and for our sport triathlon. So congratulations, guys. It's been fun having a chat.
Well, maybe we
can.
Thank you, Phil. Maybe we can get on tripod sometime.
Oh,
fantastic. Thanks, Phil.
Anytime.
Cheers. Well, Roop, a lot of good insights from Phil Rogner, first off the bike.
Yeah, he's always full of views, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
He's never been shy about throwing his view forward, has he?
No, absolutely. We really do love talking triathlon. I know we've been out and about at times, especially at one of our local haunts, the Lord Dudley here in Sydney. And I think people who hang around us are always a bit taken back by how much we actually do talk about triathlon and not cycling.
Yeah. No, it's I find it a nice change of pace. That's why I like competing, well, racing, well, doing triathlons.
Absolutely.
But it's just a nice change of pace from one sport to the other. But there is a segue there, obviously the bike is what.
Absolutely. And a lot of people don't realize this about you, but you've done 10 Ironman. I mean, you're not a rookie to the sport, and you've actually gone back, we're talking, what, 20, 30 years in the sport, and you actually raced Kona, not once, but twice.
Yeah. I've been there twice back in 85 and 86, and, I got into triathlon from lightweight rowing, and what I loved, lightweight rowing, we had to get on the scales to be able to race, to get a certain weight maximum you're allowed, and then obviously weren't able to eat that much. And then someone told me about cycling is you've got to eat. You've got to eat while you ride. And I thought, gee, eating while you're actually doing your sport? So I was hooked. And then I did triathlon. So that was a natural sort of change for me.
So obviously you just kind of got back into it about 3 years ago after a bit of a break.
Yeah.
But you went in full, like head first, because you did what, 4 in about 20 months?
Yeah, 4 and 16 months.
Yeah.
I stand corrected. It was going to be five, but then, my shoulder had to have an operation, kept on dislocating it. After the fifth dislocation, I thought I'd better get it fixed, you know.
No, absolutely. Yeah. So that's put you on hold, but any plans to go back?
Yeah, look, I'd love to go back this year, at the back end of this year. Maybe Langkawi in November,
okay.
Or maybe go back to Busselton, you know, to see how it goes.
One or the other, or perhaps both?
Well, I was thinking about both, but there's not much time between both. But then...
About 4 weeks, I believe.
About 4 weeks. And, like, I have done back-to-backs where there's been 6 weeks in between. Yeah. And I know that, you know, I can recover for 6 weeks. I don't know, for 4 weeks, I think it could be pressing it, you know, stretching it a bit too far. But we'll see.
Well, you know, I know last year, or the last time you raced in Melbourne, the Asia Pacific Championships back in 2014, you had a bit of a challenge with one two-time Olympian, Courtney Atkinson, and he gave you a two-hour handicap. That being said, it was his first Ironman, would have been your 10th. How did that come out?
Well, I came out on top, didn't I?
Oh, there you go. There you go.
No, look, I think I beat him on the handicap by about 7 minutes.
Yeah, I believe you did.
Something like that.
But... And I think you retired him from Ironman. I think he's gone back to Olympic distance now.
I broke him. He's gone back to the... Going back to the kiddies pool now.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, I don't know if Courtney even knows this, but we actually came up with that idea on the plane coming back from the Tour Down Under, didn't we?
Yeah, that's right. It was
the shenanigans to go on on an airplane.
We were plotting his future without even knowing.
Absolutely. Of course, and like we said, Courtney's actually looking. He's in the hunt to go for an historic third Olympics there in Rio. So we wish Courtney out there good luck.
What a story that'll be if he makes it. You know,
absolutely.
I mean, seems like he's going pretty well at the moment, and... you know, it just will be one of those great Olympic stories come next year when they announce the team.
Absolutely. And Courtney's always, he's a friend of the show, so we want to wish him good luck. In the meantime, look, we want to, let's kick it off to break. Our producer, Andy Brown, take us to commercial.
Here we go, guys. Copy time.
Thanks, guys.
Love it.
What they're giving me, but then I think to myself.
Welcome back to What a Ride with Rupert Guinness and Aaron S. Lee. You know, we're going back to cycling, where Rube had a chance to talk a little bit more than just the Giro, but also looking a bit towards the Tour de France and a little bit of the culture of the connection between cycling and cuisine and travel and lifestyle. He had a chance to catch up with a very special guest.
I'm sitting in Milan, or as the Italians call it, Milano. But more importantly, sitting with me, by my side, just outside the Central Station, is Gregor Brown, an Italian-based American writer and contributor for Velo News magazine in the US and also Cycling Weekly in Britain. Gregor, thanks for being on What a Ride. And it has been what a ride. It always is when we go on Grand Tours together, because we've just finished the Giro d'Italia and next we've got the Tour de France coming up. Tell me, Gregor, how did you get over here? Tell us your story. It's not all about me.
Thanks, Rupert, for having me. Yeah, no, by airplane. But no, I've been living in Italy on Lake Como for the last almost 11 years now. And I just followed my passion. I had this deep desire to get over to Europe and to see the roads where the riders raced on. It was through cycling that my imagination to Europe was opened up, because I saw these races like Liège-Bastogne-Liège and the Giro d'Italia, which we just finished. And it's all these beautiful places to an American, and probably to Australians, they're extremely different than what you see at home. So I wanted to go, and I found a way and got a visa, came over to Italy, and yeah, now 11 years have passed, and I'm pretty much Italiano.
Yeah, I'm sort of picking up on that. Every time we travel a bit more, I see you becoming more Italian than American. But I think it's great. It shows how you sort of embrace the culture and the feel, and it's not just the language, it's everything else that comes with it. Even, should I say, the attire. There is a bit of a fashionista in you, isn't there, Gregor?
Well, I'm well looked after by my Italian girlfriend and her family, and I couldn't take a step wrong if I tried to with their watchful eyes. But yeah, it's just my way of being. I don't think I put too much effort into it, but it comes across easy for me.
Tell me, Gregor, you know, like after living here, I mean, you've got a feel for where the sport of cycling sits in Italian sport, but I guess also there's football as well. And I don't know, is there something in particular about Italian sport that's different to American sport or to Anglo-Saxon sort of sports that we may be more attuned to in Australia or in Britain?
Well, a lot like Italy itself, it's everywhere you go in Italy, it's divided. There's different dialects, because Italy, it's only been a country for 150 years. Before that, it was all these little different kingdoms and such. And so Italy's a small country with not that many people, but it has a lot of different sporting teams. In Milan, there's two big football clubs, Inter Milan, International Milan, and then Milan. And then you have Juventus and Torino, and I believe it also a second Torino team there, where we just came from for the start of the last stage today. So like the country itself is divided, and even in such a small little country, you have different tifosi, different fans for each team, and they're very supportive of those teams. Cycling is down probably on the third tier after football and motorsports, with especially MotoGP, not so much Formula One anymore without Schumacher at Ferrari. But as we've been seeing on the roads of the Giro d'Italia, it is followed. And just this morning, or at the Giro d'Italia, you see fans outside the team buses and climbing up on fences, standing on their children to get a better view of the paddock. paddock area of the team bus, as it were, to see their fans, of the Fabio Aruz, the Pauletier Longos, and then the foreigners like Alberto Contador and even Richie Porte when he was still at the race.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, with you mentioned Fabio Aruz, and he came into the Giro with a lot of expectation to win it. I guess at the end of the day, he's got two fabulous stage wins and second overall, which a lot of people may not have thought he would be he would achieve just a few days ago. How much pressure is on an Italian rider, a young guy like him? I guess Vincenzo Nibali, he's a bit older and he's sort of embraced that role now. But is that for someone like Aru? How hard is that?
He says he's playing it pretty easily. The pressures come gradually. Last year, he came to the Giro d'Italia and had a third place, and that third place, he wasn't a leader of the team. They came to the Giro last year just to see what he could do. This year, and ever since this last winter, the Astana has programmed the Giro d'Italia around Fabio Aruz and Vincenzo Nibali to the Tour de France. But he's gradually dealt with it. He's been a cyclist all of his life, from Sardinia, then winning big amateur stage races like the Giro della Val d'Aosta twice, and then finishing second in the Baby Giro behind the American Joe Dombrowski in the Baby Giro's last edition. So he's gradually gotten used to that pressure, I believe. But from the outside, Fabio Aruz seems like a much more fragile person than Vincenzo Nibali. He seems very, very much more emotional, prone to cry a lot more than Vincenzo Nibali. I didn't recall Vincenzo Nibali crying as much, or maybe even crying at all. I don't recall when he won the 2013 Giro d'Italia or won the Tour de France last year, where Aruz seems much more emotional. And maybe that also what played in him not doing so well in the Giro d'Italia to start off with.
So maybe a lot of how he came good at the back end of the Giro was he managed to get a grip on it all.
I think that was probably more in strength at the end, and the bit on the front was more in emotion, because he came into this Giro after a 5-day stop due to a stomach virus, and I don't think he was up to it, and he probably worked himself into a little bit of form while he was here. But the first part of the Giro, I think, was on emotions and the team wanting to go out and stamp its authority on the race, which it did, and it has done the whole 3 weeks. So had he not had the physical capabilities to back that up, he could have paid and paid dearly for that. And even when we saw in the Mortirolo, when he was struggling, I mean, he struggled, but he limited his losses, what we say in cycling. He limited his losses to something like 2.5 minutes, where I think he said the next day he could have easily lost like 20 minutes. And his team manager, Giuseppe Martinelli, who guided many other riders to Grand Tour wins, said that day he showed that he's a Grand Tour. He has that Grand Tour potential to win a Grand Tour.
The Vincenzo Nibali, you know quite well. I was wondering, you know, we're going to see a lot more of him in July, when hopefully the big four are going to be up against each other in the Tour de France. Nibali, Alberto Contador,
Quintana,
and Chris Froome. It's really a real heavyweight division of boxing, even though they're not heavyweights in a literal sense. Tell us a little bit about Vincenzo and what's he like as a person. And I think, you know, last year's Tour we saw a bit of how tough this guy is, but maybe a lot of people don't know.
What's interesting with both Vincenzo and Aru, you have to remember, is that they both come from Italy's big islands. Aru from Sardinia, Vincenzo from Sicily. And Vincenzo, being from the south, like all good southerners, are traditionally open and friendly, and he is that. He's giving with his time and open and friendly, and obviously he's had to shut off a little bit along with stardom that's come with his win, but that's mostly at home in Italy. Abroad, with us foreign journalists, he's still pretty open. So yeah, I mean, he just came back from altitude camp, I think, not yesterday, but the day before, and yeah, he's going on to the Dauphiné for the Tour de France.
Well, it's going to be exciting to see how he backs, or how he does, not back up, how he does front up.
Yeah. His defense.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously it is his defense, so I mean, there's a lot of pressure that comes with that.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to not care. That's the trait with Nibali that everybody talks about. He's able to switch off as soon as the stage ends and relax. They were talking about that when he rode with Niki Gaskanandel, and they talk about that at Astana. He's able to switch off. After a stage, he can fall asleep right away while the team's still driving to the hotel, or even before stage, he can sleep up to the last minute, and he's able to just deflect the pressure. So that's his trait, and he seems to not care so much about if he can back up his title or not. And he doesn't seem to care or not whether people think his title last year was just given to him on a silver platter when Contador and Froome had to abandon due to their crashes. Honestly, though, I think he's going to have a very, very hard time against Quintana, especially Quintana and Contador and Froome this year.
Just going back to Italy, I mean, you know the country well, you know the people well, the history, the food. Now, just a bit of a traveller's tip. How the hell do you travel around Italy without stacking the kilos on? I mean, I run every day and I still get fat here.
You don't see your creamy bow tie or farfalle pasta with salmon in Italy. A lot of their place have olive oil. They're pretty healthy. Even their salads are usually pretty healthy without many creamy dressings like what we'd have in the United States on top of them. So every step in the process is natural to them. They're not thinking about it, but they do eat pretty healthy. Although, yes, we do eat a lot of pasta. Even at home, I have two plates of pasta a day, and I try not to. However, yeah, I mean, we're here outside the Stazione Centrale, the central station, and there's a McDonald's around the corner, and fast food is becoming more popular in Italy. There's still not a Starbucks in Italy, thankfully. But yeah, that Italians, I don't know. I guess it's just that healthy food. It seems like unhealthy, but it is. It's mostly healthy.
I noticed, you know, wherever we travel, every night you take a photo of your dinner or lunch. I notice you don't take photos of breakfast. But what's the reason behind that? And do you go back over those photos and try and sort of study them again?
That's basically because I have a bad memory and I like to remember what I've been eating and where I've been along the way. Yeah, and also because I'm on TripAdvisor quite a bit too, and so sometimes I'll post ratings, although when I'm traveling for work, usually I do not. Yes, that's why I take the photos. It's the journalist in me to record and observe and take notes, yeah.
Well, just as we're speaking now, our lunch has just been served. What are we having for lunch?
The Piadina, which is from Emilia Romagna, where the area where Marco Pantani came from, and his parents owned a Piadina stand, and they're made a little bit differently in Emilia Romagna, thicker Piadinas, where a Piadina looks like a tortilla, yeah, it's just easy. It's folded. It's like a sandwich on a tortilla or a Piadina instead of bread, so it's easier to get down. Doesn't bloat you as much, which, you know, we're thinking about as journalists, you know, when we travel 3 weeks on the Giro d'Italia.
Well, I'm pretty hungry. I know you are, Gregor. We've had a good long drive, and you've had a good long drive. I had a little snooze in the car, but it's been great traveling with you as always, and also talking with you. We're on the road, different countries, different adventures. Much for your insight. Thank you on what a ride.
Thanks, and thanks for what a ride.
Root, fantastic interview with Gregor Brown. That was it really kind of hits home the dynamic of just how big cycling is, and really what it brings to the table in terms of not just racing as a professional sport, but the culture.
Yeah, it certainly does. I mean, I've known Gregor for a long time now, and we actually, you know, we travel together at the Grand Tours, the Giro and the Tour. So I've known him for a while. I know his good and bad habits, and it was just nice to be able to present some of Gregor Brown to everybody.
Well, as a fellow American, he's got to be a good egg.
You would say that.
Well, Rube, that'll do it for this episode of What a Ride. Mate, always great to see you.
Oh, it was great. You know, it was a great start to the show. I was really excited about what we're doing and the people we've had on board for the first episode. I think, they've really provided us with some interesting insights and some recourse for some friendly banter. And you know, good times to come, I think.
Absolutely. We want to say special thanks to some of the people that are on the show today. Obviously, the Velaroos and Julianne Hazlett, and we wish them good luck. Obviously, go to their website, thevelaroos.com, to get more information on them. We want to thank Maddie White, Gregor Brown, Phil Rockner, and of course, we want to thank our producer, Australian Broadcast Media, Andy Brown, for you know, bringing this to life.
Exactly. Where would we be without
Thanks,
Andy?
Guys.
Absolutely. Until next time, keep
Your
it rubber.
Is in the bolts.
Until then, keep it rubber side down, and remember, a meter matters. We'll catch you next time on What a Ride.